that type of budget, you should have two riders that are capable of winning. Because Chris, one crash, boom, he's out.
What went wrong last year? I crashed. I fell off my bike.
Halfway through the massage, there's a knock on the door, and it's Ryder, standing there with a cup for me. Made you a juice, Dave.
What's quite worrying is we're still in Derbyshire, and it feels like we've been cycling for a week.
Morale good, though?
No, not really.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm in sunny London with Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Sorry, a bit of hilarity there before we even started. Lionel, where are we?
We're outside a pub called the Checkers Tavern in central London, sort of in a courtyardy, well, basically standing on the street.
Where have we been?
We've been in the Rafa Cafe watching the Giro d'Italia, but we couldn't record in there because we lost our table and there was nowhere to sit.
It was absolutely mobbed, wasn't it? They've got a rule in the Rafa Cafe. They don't serve anybody in the final 10 kilometres of the race, which is quite good unless you really want a coffee, I guess.
And on a day like today with an uphill finish, that's about half an hour that the staff get to just not be serving anyone, which must be a perk of the job, I guess.
It's a bit like the crash neutralisation rule, isn't it? No service in the last 10 kilometres in the Rafa Cafe, no time lost in the last 3 kilometres if anyone crashes or punctures.
It's exactly like that. Shall we kick off things? We've got a lot to talk about with the Giro heating up. Tour of California going on as well. We'll speak a little bit about that. Daniel's just back from the Giro. But let's kick off with your weekly roundup, Lionel. Hit it.
The Giro d'Italia is underway. So far, what have we seen? Orica Greenedge won the team time trial in San Remo. Elia Viviani won for Team Sky, the first sprint stage. Michael Matthews won a stage. Davide Formolo won a stage. And today's stage won by Jan Polans of Lampre, the first uphill finish or major uphill finish to Abatone. Until today, Wednesday, the pink jersey has been dominated by Orica Greenedge with Simon Gerrans, Michael Matthews and Simon Clark all wearing it, but Alberto Contador has taken it now and will hold it all the way to the finish of the Giro d'Italia in Milan.
Well, that is traditionally the case, isn't it? I don't think Contador's ever lost a leader's jersey once he's worn it, other than when he's had it taken away from him retrospectively by the UCI, as happened at the Giro in 2011, of course, and the Tour in 2010. Sorry, Lionel, you were going to come back in.
Well, just the rest of the cycling news from around the world. The Tour of California is ongoing. Mark Cavendish won the opening two stages there. A little-known Latvian called Tom Skojans won in San Jose. Did he know the way to San Jose? He certainly did. It was marked with arrows, I suppose. Don't cringe at that. That's a decent joke. Brian Cockard was second in the 4 days of Dunkirk. Friend of the podcast, you can get a Brian Cockard t-shirt by visiting thecyclingpodcast.com and clicking on shop if that lights your candle. And finally, Sir Bradley Wiggins was on Desert Island Discs and his favourite songs were Roll Out the Barrel, there'll be Bluebirds Over the White Cliffs of Dover and the National Anthem, of course. So tune into that. You can listen to that on the BBC's catch-up service on the iTunes.
Well, I liked his alternative national anthem, which was The Queen is Dead by the Smiths, which was an inspired choice. You seem in a very giddy mood today, Lionel. What's eating or not eating you?
Sun shining. It's great. Giro's on. Plenty to watch on the television in the afternoons. It just makes life a bit more enjoyable. And the People's Grand Tour is ongoing, so I'm riding my bike every day.
I know that you've been keeping Daniel, as the T-shirt maestro, a close eye on T-shirt sales. Have we sold any Brian Cockard T-shirts?
I'm not sure, and I'm not sure there's been the spike we hoped for after the Prudy Ibiza remix last week, but I will monitor that and I'll report back.
What's the opposite of a spike, a slump? I think there's been a slump in sales following the Ibiza remix. I think that was a one-off. I think we can safely say that was a one-off.
Did you notice the coincidence of Thomas Carreau, friend of the podcast, quitting his job as the ASO press chief the day after we released the Prudy remix? I think he's moved into a different department, upwards and onwards into a different department.
Wow, you learn something new every day on this podcast. Giro, let's talk about the Giro. Daniel, you were over there for the opening weekend. Tell us how it was. What did you find out?
Well, starting San Remo. San Remo, obviously, one of the iconic Italian towns as far as cycling is concerned, for other reasons. The town where the Milano San Remo finishes. I thought it was a great opening time trial course on a bike path. There was some sort of, there was a bit of anxiety about the width of the bike path, how it was going to stack up, whether there were going to be crashes, whether it was going to literally stack up. I thought it looked fantastic on TV. As far as the race was concerned, not a big surprise, Orica Green Edge winning. They were the favourites. Some good performances from Astana, I thought, Tinkoff Saxo. And then we've seen some fantastic racing since then. It's been a brilliant advert for Liguria, the region, the last few days. Fantastic helicopter shops of the Cinque Terre yesterday, which I would recommend as a holiday destination to anyone.
And they went through Barga today, the Scottish town in Tuscany.
Yeah, which you learn something every day, don't you? Because you told me about this earlier and I had no idea that such a thing existed.
Very strong links Barga has with Scotland, and you go there, as I did a few years ago, and a lot of the Italians there speak with a broad Scottish accent. When they ask if you speak English, they then launch into sort of Glaswegian Italian version of English. It's surreal, but hugely entertaining. A lot of them were born in the west coast of Scotland and went back to Barga, but yeah, very strong links between Scotland and Barga. There you go. That was it. That was all.
What do you want me to talk about now?
Tell us more about your weekend away.
Well, you know, I think we all saw the racing was fantastic. We saw Pippo Pozzato, friend of the podcast, in San Remo. He was kicking about. The latest news on Pippo is that he was very disgruntled not to be picked in the Giro team for Lampre. He's sort of been penciled in for the Tour. Rui Costa wants him there. Very complicated first few stages in the north of France. They think he could be an asset for those stages. Some reservations about whether he might be riding sort of to preserve his status in the Lampre team. It is hashtag contract year for Pippo, after all, we know that. So, we saw him there. He was enjoying himself in San Remo.
Did he not hijack a hen party?
Well, yes, he did. It would be incorrect to say that the hen party hijacked or accosted Pippo. It was more the other way around. There was a group of young ladies walking past the bar where Pippo was enjoying himself on Saturday night, and he was sure, or he made sure that they took a few selfies with him as souvenirs.
Wow. The Giro without Pozzato, it doesn't quite feel complete, does it, really?
He hasn't actually ridden a Giro very often.
I mean, the Giro is only a few days old, but it really ignited on that stage four. It was an extraordinary stage, not a mountainous stage in particular, but a short stage, an explosive stage, where, as we've seen in the Giro, on previous occasions, a big group went clear. We saw a similar scenario back in 2010 when a big group escaped in that first week. Bradley Wiggins was in it and claimed a lot of time. And this was a 25-man group. Roman Kreuziger from Tinkoff Saxo was in it, and he was the real sort of outside danger man. And it looked like a masterstroke from Tinkoff Saxo, potentially, because Kreuziger is a legitimate plan B for Tinkoff Saxo behind Alberto Contador. But it kind of backfired a little bit, perhaps, on Tinkoff Saxo, because in the end, Astana chased hard and kind of left Contador quite exposed, because in the end, he was left with only one teammate, Michael Rogers. Now, there's also, I think, a discussion to be had about the way that Tinkoff Saxo have been riding the first few days. They've really been controlling the race from day one, riding very, very hard. Why have they been doing that? It's puzzled a lot of people, I think.
Well, whether it's got something to do with the fact that Oleg Tinkoff himself has been in the team car for much of those first four stages, we don't know. Tinkoff was actually on his way home to his villa in Forte dei Marmi. He's got a villa in Tuscany. Yesterday, he got a call from one of the direct sportifs. They told him it was all kicking off in the race. He did a U-turn, went straight back to the race. I'm not sure if he got back in the team car, but he was certainly there at the finish yesterday. Strange tactics, like you said, Rich. It was a masterstroke. It seemed like a masterstroke, except Tinkoff obviously didn't see it that way, because they were riding, they said they were riding tempo just to contain the gap, just to keep it at around 10 minutes, or certainly not allow it to get any higher than that. But it looked to me as though they were going very, very hard, and that was borne out by the fact that the majority of their team was dropped quite badly in the latter phases of that stage. They recovered today, I would say. They rode a pretty decent race today. Basso lost, I think, around 20 minutes yesterday on the road to La Spezia. He was quite good again today, quite influential. And, you know, Contador is just bulletproof, really, as far as, you know, all this turbulence in the team over the past 3 or 4 months we've seen in the past. I mean, if you look at Contador's career, he's really never been in a team where there hasn't been turmoil, yet everything has just bounced off him. So, you know, if his rivals are hanging their hopes on Contador imploding because of external pressures, I think they're probably barking up the wrong tree.
But that makes it all the more surprising, does it not, the way that Tinkoff Saxo have been riding. He's now in the pink jersey. He's never lost it in a Grand Tour, but it's very, very, very early to be leading the race. And if Tinkoff Saxo have been controlling up to now, we can just expect more of the same, can we not, Lionel?
Well, it depends how long their legs will stand it. I mean, there's an awful lot of that invisible to the TV viewer, at least, work to be done. They had to control. If they were controlling when they didn't have the pink jersey, now that they've got it, their workload is certainly not going to be reduced. And you have to wonder the kind of influence that Oleg Tinkoff is bringing to bear on the team and the kind of pressure that being put on them, whether they can get through still 2.5 weeks with all the really difficult mountain stages still to come. Said it in last week's podcast, talking about how the Giro, the pattern is established on the first kind of uphill finish, and then really we get a sort of repeat of that, and the best climbers come to the fore on the first occasion, and then that pattern is repeated through the race. I don't expect anything different, except that Tinkoff Saxo are going to have to do a heck of a lot. And they, when you look at the screen, just a real sort of visual kind of impression of who's strong, you do see more sort of turquoisey baby blue than you do see fluorescent yellow, and that just instant snapshot gives you an impression of which team is the strongest. And Astana have got more men, I think, than Tinkoff Saxo will have.
Yeah, a couple of things I'd add. I think three of the real winners of this first week of the Giro d'Italia have been Nairo Quintana, Vincenzo Nibali and Chris Froome. They must be watching the Giro and just licking their lips at how difficult it's been and what a hard time Aru's been giving them, Richie Porte's been giving them. And also just on Tinkoff, I know that Sagan is quite concerned about certainly the pressure that's coming from Tinkoff, and there have been various conversations. Even the hints, suggestions that Sagan's 3-year contract at Tinkoff might not run its course. I think that one of the problems there is that Tinkoff regards Sagan as very much Bjarne Riis's man, also because Sagan's agent is Giovanni Lombardi, the Italian former rider who was a very, very good friend of Bjarne Riis's. And Riis and Lombardi together sort of engineered the deal, and now that Riis is gone, what I'm hearing from the team is that Tinkoff is putting extra pressure and extra stress on anyone he associates with Riis, and Sagan is very much in that bracket.
Just on Tinkoff and his sort of ever presence as the team's figurehead, and particularly now that he's putting himself in the team car, he says he's not calling tactics or anything like that, but he is he's clearly taking a much more high profile role than most team owners would perhaps. What's the sense in Italy in a press coverage? Is there any kind of backlash against this? Because I just look at it and think, you know, this is like Roman Abramovich giving press conferences, sending out tweets, talking about team selection and football players. You know, he's the owner of Chelsea, but he doesn't have any kind of public profile. He doesn't get involved in any footballing matters. He doesn't interfere with Jose Mourinho, the manager. And in this case, Tinkoff, if he was in football, he would be torn to shreds, I think, by the media for his conduct. I mean, it's great for us as journalists because it gives us something to laugh and smile at, something to talk about. But in terms of the kind of serious profile of the Tinkoff Saxo team, aren't they in danger of looking a little bit like a laughingstock if this carries on through the rest of the summer?
Absolutely. And I think however much Tinkoff protests about not interfering with the direct sportive's decisions and their tactics in the race, I think the reality is that he does have a large say in what's going on. You know, there were long conversations I hear between Michael Rogers, obviously one of the most experienced riders at Tinkoff Saxo and probably their road captain, and the direct sportive during the race yesterday, very animated conversations, a suggestion that Rogers didn't really agree with their tactics. They were certainly very odd, the tactics, when they were really driving hard on the front when they had Kreuziger up the road.
Who was also working hard. Kreuziger was doing a lot in that front move.
Yeah, and Kreuziger, of all the guys down the road, he was probably the guy with the greatest Grand Tour pedigree. You know, Cataldo was down the road for Astana, but Etics had no one, and that was the perfect opportunity to just really put Etics on the ropes. And okay, you know, Aran is not the main favourite for the Giro d'Italia, but it would have forced them to really work and flog their domestiques all day, and they didn't do that. It was the Tinkoff domestiques that ended up having the hardest day. So a lot of strange things going on at the moment. I had a Twitter exchange yesterday with Stephen de Jong, who's the Tinkoff Saxo, well, the head director. I had a Twitter exchange with his wife, Renee. She assured me that they would know what they were doing. I gave them the benefit of the doubt. But yeah, the jury was still out at the end of the day, I think.
Right, well, let's take a little break, come back and talk about Davide Formolo, who won that stage in quite magnificent fashion. And you spoke to Charlie Wagelius, Daniel, the Cannondale Garmin director. So we'll come back and we'll hear from Charlie and talk about Formolo.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
So in amidst all the discussion over the tactics of Tinkoff Saxo, that big 25-man group that gained 10 minutes, a young rider, 13-year-old Davide Formolo, he looks about 13, sneaked off, a great prospect, but I don't think he was somebody who considered himself a potential stage winner at the Giro even. He's very much an emerging talent. Cannondale Garmin have had a torrid season so far, really no results to speak of, really. And you spoke to Charlie Wagelius at the weekend, Daniel, the director sportif, about the season so far and a bit about Formolo as well, I think.
Yeah, I did. I mean, they'd had 26 World Tour points up to that point, by far the worst tally of any team in the World Tour. Really struggled. Obviously, they've taken on a lot of the Italian riders from the now defunct Cannondale team over the winter. In terms of camaraderie, in terms of cohesion in the team, it's gone quite well. They've integrated fairly well, but as far as results are concerned, it really hasn't. And it's a team that really lacks a banker. It really lacks someone who will guarantee 5 to 10 wins a year. And you know, that's been their problem at the start of the year. They haven't had a sprinter to sort of relieve the pressure. They've been relying on breakaways, on young guys like Formolo. He hasn't ridden brilliantly so far this season, but certainly looks as though he's coming to form in time for the Giro. So yeah, I spoke to Charlie in Albenga, I think, on the morning of stage two, about the crisis, or what at that time we were perceiving as a crisis at Cannondale Garmin, and also about Formolo's prospects in the Giro d'Italia. Charlie, just to quickly analyse yesterday's performance in the team time trial.
I think we could have started quicker. I think we kind of lost a little bit of form and a little bit of rhythm after the corners of the time check, about 10Ks in. But I think otherwise the guys executed technically very well. You know, and I think if you look at the average weight of our riders, they didn't do too bad at all.
It's been a fairly difficult start to the season, at least on paper. You've got a young team. Is it difficult to keep morale up when the wins are hard to come by? And I mean, you must have experienced this as a rider.
Yeah, I think, you know, bike riders, by their nature, they're ambitious and they want to do well. And it's always better to live in a team that's winning a lot of races. But that's the life of a cyclist. You lose much more than you win. And I think the team, the morale in the team is really excellent, you know, and everybody's still going about their jobs in a really thorough way. And I think if you look at the results of the spring, very few teams won a lot. So there's a lot of people in the same position, and I think it's very, very early to still start drawing conclusions, especially for a team like ours.
Is it difficult to make sure the riders don't get desperate, though, and don't make rash decisions because they feel that pressure?
When I was 21, Patrick Lefebvre told me that panic is a bad advisor. And I think that was very true. You know, and if you look at our spring, the year before, Langeveld took 2 top 10 places in the Classics, in the Cobble Classics. And this year he crashed quite heavily, and that compromised his spring campaign. The same goes for Dan Martins in the Ardennes. He crashed in Flèche Wallonne. He also crashed in Liège, Best in Liège. So, you know, that already has an impact. But beyond the story of the points, there's a lot of good things happening. You know, I think the development of the young riders is going very, very well. I think the insertion of the two groups together has gone extremely well, considering, you know, where they come from. So I think, you know, these kinds of things are going to bear fruit later on.
There's been a lot of, well, hype, enthusiasm about Formolo, and he had a fantastic year last year. Jonathan said he'll win the Giro in future. I mean, he's had a fairly sort of a good but discreet start to the season. How do you envisage his next 3 weeks going?
The plan for Davide is really genuinely day by day. We did the same thing with Dylan Van Baarle here last year, and he went on to ride extremely well in June. He's here, everybody knows that he's got a lot of potential and a lot of talent, but he's here to learn how to do his job. And the more you guys are leaving him in peace to do that, the happier I'd be. So we're putting absolutely no limits on him. He's got the chance to learn next to somebody like Ryder, who's won a three-week race, and I don't even know how many riders are still in activity who's even done that. We take it day by day, and the moment he's in difficulty, we're going to reassess, give him a few easier days as far as he can in a race like this, improvise the plan going on. But that doesn't mean we're putting any limits on him, because he's also got quite a winner's mentality, you know. So he's happy to be here. I think he's realising a dream from his childhood, but he's here to learn and learn how to do the job.
So Charlie Wigelius there addressing the Cannondale Garmin crisis that seemed to be prevailing at the time you were speaking to him. But, you know, that puts a real gloss on things for them. Formolo is a talent, isn't he? And seems like a very appealing character as well. What can you tell us about him, Daniel?
Yeah, he's very reminiscent in terms of character of Ivan Basso. Some people will balk when they hear that. But Basso sort of picked him out straight away when he joined Cannondale last year as a real prospect. There was a race, the GP Lugano, at the start of last year where Basso almost had to tell him off because he was doing too much work and he was too strong. But he is... he's really a godsend for Cannondale Garmin because they have inherited a lot of Italian riders. Not all of them have been doing particularly well. Moreno Moser, who was the the great white hope of Italian cycling a couple of years ago, is really sinking without trace at the moment. But Formolo is the guy who now looks as though he might develop into the leader and the sort of figurehead almost of that Cannondale Garmin team. If we disregard Dan Martin for a moment, he's probably the best, most saleable asset that they have. He's a very good climber. Like Basso, doesn't accelerate particularly well, tends to go well on longer, steadier climbs. Time trialing is probably a weakness at the moment, but that's certainly the direction that his career will probably develop in. He will become a very good stage racer. I mean, there were echoes yesterday in his ride of what Damiano Cunego did in 2004, where he sort of burst onto the scene, won that Giro d'Italia. Formolo won't win the Giro, I'm pretty sure of that. I think Jonathan Vortus thinks that he's a future Giro d'Italia winner. I think, you know, he might not be wrong there, but he won't win this Giro. He could well finish in the top 10. He's already saved Garmin's Giro, saved the first part of the season for them to a large extent. So an exciting prospect.
He looks about 13, but sounds about 30. He's got a very deep voice, hasn't he? Lionel, what are your thoughts on Formolo and Garmin? We should say that the 2 days, these two very exciting days, both won by young, promising young riders, Jan Polans, the Slovenian rider, also a very young and very promising rider. While this sort of battle has been raging between the favourites, you know, quite good to see these young, exciting young riders winning.
I wonder if Jan Polans remembers this tour of Slovenia in 1998 and the stage that I was telling you guys about earlier, when one unnamed rider apparently did the whole stage in a camping car and jumped out and rode the last 2 kilometres.
Well, it's camping cars. We're going to talk in the next part about the revelation that Richie Porte is sleeping in a motorhome this year. We're calling this accommodation doping. Lionel,
should just explain that the reason he went in the camping car, according to your story, was that he'd left his shoes in the hotel, hadn't taken them with him, so didn't have any cycling shoes, so couldn't ride the whole stage in flip flops. So rode the stage.
Should we reveal the source of this story? The source was Matt White, the Orica Green Edge team manager, and we're going to eke this out of him before the end of the Tour de France, let's say. We're going to find out who the rider was. It was a teammate of Matt's. I think Matt at that time was riding for US Postal. So we're going to go back. We're going to study the results.
Not a team that you would associate with cheating of any type, is it?
No. But your question about what you think of when young riders emerge, it just makes me feel increasingly old. It's... formula.
You are increasingly old, Lionel. We all are increasingly old. But
this is the thing, you know, so much baloney is talked about young riders and the emergence of young riders and so-and-so looks. I know, you're shaking your head. This isn't a negative point. Hang on, we have had this before. But Formolo, you know, he was 5 years old when Pantani won the Giro in 1998, you know, which kind of puts into context for anyone who's been watching the sport for 20-odd years. These kids are coming through. I think there's a massive distinction between young riders who show promise in lesser events and young riders who come through and win a Grand Tour stage in the manner that Formolo and also the Slovenian rider did today. Because, you know, getting big, big wins on the board early on in a career can really... That's what really marks out the future talent, rather than people who, you know, maybe do well in... lesser stage races.
And by the way, in the Pantani era and just thereafter, 22-year-old riders didn't win stages like that. They really didn't. This has been a very encouraging thing that's been happening the last few years, that young riders, and I always remember Greg LeMond, you know, Bernardino, these were guys who at 21, 22, 23 won major races, and for quite a few years that didn't happen, and it's happening again, and I think that's very encouraging. Daniel, you also you're shaking your head. In Italy, you also, of course, bumped into our good friend Ciro Scognamiglio. Tell us about Ciro. I think you got us a dispatch from Ciro.
I did. But Ciro was sort of hysterical throughout the whole time we were in Liguria. I think that had something to do with the proximity of the sea. We were hugging the coast for most of the first 4 days, and Ciro was very much in his element. Anyway, it was Ciro's suggestion that we introduce a new feature to the podcast for the next 3 weeks. We're not really sure how we're going to record it yet, but it's the Ciro d'Italia. And here is the first installment. I think this was recorded in the press room in Genoa, a very beautiful press room in the Palazzo Ducale in Genoa on the third day. So here I am talking to Ciro for the Ciro d'Italia.
Thanks to everyone, first of all. My verdict was good, because fortunately I was able to follow all the time trial near a marvelous beach. And I also put the photo on Twitter. So this verdict was the more important for me. And then there was also the race. But, I mean, it's really so important, I guess.
You're really enjoying this start, aren't you, in San Remo on the Riviera Ligure? Lots of beaches, sunshine. It's perfect for you.
For me, it's perfect. But you know that maybe for that I'm not really still concentrating on the race, I must confess.
Okay, but let's...
But if you want, we could also talk about the race.
Let's try to talk about the race.
Yeah.
Astana yesterday, some people were surprised by how well Astana rode yesterday. Giuseppe Martinelli, the director sportive, wasn't surprised.
No, exactly. I spoke yesterday night with him, more or less. It was also after 11 p.m., but he told me, yes, I mean, it has been a good performance, but I'm not really surprised, yes.
And Fabio Aru, in spite of the illness that he had, he seems to be healthy, he seems to be fit, he seems to be confident. I noticed though, Ciro yesterday was doing a lot of interviews, a lot of posing for selfies, for photos, signing autographs. It's all very tiring, as you know yourself, because you know you get stopped often, and on the Giro when we leave the press room, you get stopped for selfies. And it really takes its toll over 3 weeks, doesn't it?
Yeah, maybe I could become in the future, because you know my work of journalist is not really a work, but I could teach Fabio Aru how to be able to resist to this kind of pressure. You know, selfies, the relationship between the fans, tifosi, I'm really, well, I mean, for me, it's So I could teach him this, yeah.
But you're confident about Aru's chances?
Not to win the Giro. No. My opinion, not because there is such a long time trial, 60K. There is Contador also, Uran is really strong. My opinion, maybe Aru won't be the winner of the Giro this year. I hope he could win, but not this year for me.
Not the Giro, maybe the Giro d'Italia. Maybe he'll win the Giro d'Italia.
Why not?
Right, let's just look briefly at the stages that are going to come immediately after the podcast goes out on Thursday. So let's look. We've got the Garibaldi here, the route book.
Yes.
I'm sure they're going to need some beaches along the way. Castiglione de la Pescaia, straight to that. That's a nice coastal resort. Isn't it, on Thursday. Then we're getting down towards your territory. We're getting down south, Ciro. The Giro doesn't go very far south this year, but we do go quite close to Napoli, don't we, your hometown, around about the weekend, I think, isn't it?
Yes, because the weekend will be maybe the second Finnish climb on the Finnish climbing in Campidello Matese on Saturday. I mean, should be, but the Campidello Matese climb is not really hard, no? But also the stage of Sunday between Benevento and San
Giorgio. This is your home stage, isn't it? You'll be the favourite for this stage.
Yeah, exactly, but it's not... it's not near to the beach, but as you see in the profile of the stage, I mean, it's a little bit country. It's kind of a tricky stage, and so also meant for the GC has to be careful of this stage. Yeah,
and that's on Sunday. So on a week today, next Sunday, do you think we'll have seen big time gaps between the leaders?
In my opinion, not really. Still not really, because between Abetone, Campitello Matese, I mean, there are climbs, but not really hard. In my opinion, the really big battle between the main rival for the pink jersey will be after the maxi time trial, 60K, and later, not before.
And last thing, Ciro. So the Giro is about a race, it's a 3 week, it's a grand tour, but it's also this great incubator of gossip. We get a lot of gossip on the Giro, don't we? Anything this morning, anything the last couple of days?
About gossip?
Any scoops?
Well, we saw. Yeah, I mean, also you, Daniel, we have maybe the same scope. I mean, we saw one of our favorite riders, Filippo Pozzato, in the nights of Sanremo, I mean, really late in the night. What was he doing? This is our question, and maybe next time we could reveal this to our listeners. Why not? But also, we could also, for our listeners, and everyone knows that we organize something for the first weekend of June in London for the Bradley Wiggs World Hour attempt. Maybe I could put my sign on one Garibaldi of the Giro d'Italia, and it's really, you can easily understand how can be of value this, and we could give one Garibaldi with my sign to one of our listeners.
The Garibaldi being the road book, the Giro d'Italia official road book, not available to normal punters.
And as you can easily imagine, also my sign is not easily available, Daniel.
Sure, I think you're in danger of believing in your own hype here. We need to, the scoops, the gossip that I asked you about, what specifically have you found out in the last couple of days that you'd like to share with the listeners?
I mean,
about Pozzato, for instance, I was speaking to Luca Guercileno of Trek. We speak to him pretty much every year at this time of year, saying, are you going to save Pippo Pozzato? Because they go back a long way, and Luca pretty much always says the same thing. Money is a problem, but he also now has a problem of too many Italians in the Trek team.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, also in 2016, I don't think that Luca and Pippo will work together again. No, I don't think so. Yes.
And Kwiatkowski, that story is developing, isn't it? Michal?
My opinion, already we spoke maybe as the first in the podcast about Kwiatkowski, but I could add another thing. My opinion, not only Kwiatkowski should go to Sky next year, my opinion almost done, but also another Polish guy, Golas.
Wow. What a huge...
Only for you.
What a huge groundbreaking scoop that is. Okay, well, Ciro, we're going to leave it here. I'm not sure when the next appointment of the Ciro d'Italia is going to be. Maybe this time next week. We'll sort something out, won't we? We always do.
For sure, Ciro d'Italia is more important than Giro d'Italia. I hope that this is clear for our listeners, but I think so.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast and British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Coming up on British Eurosport, and thank you very much once again to British Eurosport for the sponsorship of the Cycling Podcast. Coming up on the home of cycling, of course, throughout May until the 31st of May, live coverage of the Giro d'Italia with lead commentator Rob Hatch. He'd been joined this week by Matt Stevens, but I think Sean Kelly, after his knee operation, is rejoining Matt behind the hockey this weekend.
Can I just say about the home of cycling? Rob Hatch left his washing in the machine again today, which he does for every World Tour race. Every single World Tour race that he has commentated on this season, he's left home and he's left his washing in the machine.
Shocking. Also on British Eurosport at the moment is the Tour of California being broadcast live, and that runs until the 17th of May. Now, we mentioned in the last part that we were going to discuss Richie Porte's Porta home.
Porta cabin.
Yeah, Richie Porte is not sleeping in the team hotel, although that option is open to him should he want to sleep in the team hotel. He is sleeping in a motorhome. There was a plan of the motorhome in Gazzetta dello Sport today, I think. They seem to have got a floor plan.
Ciro has been working very hard on this story.
My understanding is that this is just the first phase of a plan that Team Sky have to manage the conditions in which their riders live and sleep, and it might extend beyond the team leader at some point. It might encompass the whole team. There might be a mobile Team Sky village. But the motorhome idea is clearly the latest marginal gain, I guess. It's a logical development from taking your own mattresses, which they've been doing since 2010. But what do we think of the motorhome?
Well, the idea, I'm led to believe, comes from Mark Cavendish or Cal Crutchlow, who is a MotoGP rider, I think. Is it MotoGP or is it Superbike? I think MotoGP.
Anyway, motorcyclist.
He's a good friend of Mark Cavendish's, lives on the Isle of Man, born in Coventry, actually, like me. Anyway... Cal Crutchlow, I think, visited Team Sky when Cavendish was riding for them at the 2012 Tour of Britain. He was quite curious about sleeping arrangements of the riders. He was... Linus, what does that look, Lionel?
Just as... Yeah, I suppose, yeah, yeah. I mean, carry on, Daniel, yeah, sorry.
Anyway... he was quite puzzled as to why all the riders were sleeping in hotels, why they don't have a system like the one that operates in MotoGP with a paddock, and the riders have their own motorhomes and they never have to unpack. They're there the whole time. It's a controlled environment. So Cavendish then suggested to Dave Brailsford that they adopt a similar system at Team Sky. I'm not sure quite what the complications were at the time, maybe logistics, maybe money, but 3 years later, here we are, Richie Porte at the Giro d'Italia sleeping in his own caravan.
I mean, it is bizarre that riders share rooms, isn't it, as they do?
That was exactly what I was going to say. I mean, these are increasingly wealthy sports people, and on the Tour de France, particularly when we spend a lot of time hanging around in team hotel lobbies, we're often in a really run-down sort of place, a chain hotel, an Ibis or a Campanile. That's not to defame those particular hotels, but very often the hotels that the teams are put in by the organisers are not necessarily...
It'll be up to the lawyers whether you defame the hotels.
Well, I mean, they're not like five-star, blue-chip, salubrious places often. And sometimes, I mean, I've seen some real shockers. I remember on the tour in about 2005, the Euskaltel team were in a Formula One, and it said in the hotel book that they were to have their dinner in the Buffalo Grill on the opposite side of the auto route from where they were staying.
That's like an absolute dream. But it is strange, but it's also not strange because... You know, maybe 2,000 or the Tour de France might require 3,000 hotel rooms. You know, that's based on a lot of riders sharing. If you multiply that by two, it's 6,000.
There aren't 3,000 riders.
Okay, let's say just the riders in the race. Okay, that's double the number of rooms. It's already very difficult to find hotels within a reasonable distance of the stage start, stage finishes. So it makes sense on that level. it's also the races. In the vast, vast majority of cases, the races pay for the hotels. It's not the teams that pay. I can kind of understand it as well.
The thing about the motorhome is, right now we're all kind of scoffing at this and thinking it's ridiculous, and you know, accommodation doping is the next frontier in performance enhancement, if you like.
Which Contador benefited from last night, didn't he? Because he stayed at Tinkov's aforementioned villa in Forte dei Marmi.
I think there used to be much stricter rules about, you know, riders, where they stayed and how they travelled, etc., etc. However, you know, we're laughing about this now, but, you know, if it proves to be successful, if there's a perceived advantage, could it go in the way that, you know, when Once turned up with their team bus in the early 90s, people scoffed and laughed, said, this is ridiculous, this is a sledgehammer to crack a nut. But, you know, if it becomes the thing that a team leader wants and requires and demands, you know, could it take off?
Well, it will do. And, I mean, when you talk about the accommodation in the past, I mean, teams used to stay, particularly in mountain stages on the Tour de France, they'd sometimes be in dormitories. Or, you know, the ANC Halfords team were, in 1987, they were very bottom of the food chain, probably the last team in, if you like. And they spent a number of nights during that tour staying in dorms, you know, with sort of just partitions in between beds, and you're next to not just one teammate but maybe five or six teammates snoring and farting and all the rest of it, you know. So the sport is progressing, the athletes are much better paid. I mean, the point about the accommodation being decided by the race organisers, you never see ASO in a bad hotel. You know, you sometimes see that's the race organiser of the Tour de France. They take the best hotel rooms, and then probably sponsors and other VIPs get the next best, and then the teams really are kind of, then if not at the bottom of the food chain, they are not the highest consideration. And I think we saw perhaps 10 years ago the start of teams taking their own chefs. Team Sky began to transport their own mattresses around. It is a logical step that you want to control the environment for the riders as best you can. And one point that I saw made very well on Twitter by somebody was that if a rider's suffering with some kind of, you know, getting through the race but has come down with a sniffle or a bit of a cold, you don't want to be sharing a room with that guy because you
just
might
put him in another room. And I said, as I said to Rich earlier,
somebody's got to share.
No,
you know?
Not necessarily. That happens, you know. I mean, Bradley Wiggins had his own room in 2012, and riders who've been ill have been isolated. That's happened consistently.
But this is taking that level of logistics on another step, isn't it? I mean, it's enabling the team to control the environment for the most important guy in the team. My question at the moment would be, do the other eight riders in the team think, oh, well, Richie's out in his porta cabin, you know.
I think it's bound to create resentment, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, I think segregation is a big problem. I spoke to a couple of riders about this week, and also had a chat with the ethics DS Jan Schaffrath. He was talking about the various arrangements they had at High Road. They had quite a small bus, a very low-tech bus, but they also had a camper van. He said the atmosphere was always so much better in the camper van because, you know, there was no Wi-Fi, no one was on their phones, they were bumping into each other. It threw up some quite amusing situations. And it baffles me slightly. And I just don't understand, Rich, you would know better than me, how do Team Sky afford this kind of thing? It must be costing an absolute fortune.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, and as I say, the rumour is that it's just phase one of a bigger plan.
To their credit, they didn't announce this in a press release with, you know, in the way that they did with the suspension at Paris-Roubaix, which attracted quite a lot of scorn and criticism, and it made it very easy for people to sneer at them when it didn't really work. They didn't do that. They kept it fairly quiet, didn't they? And it was a couple of journalists who actually found out that this was what was happening.
Yeah, I mean, it remains to be seen whether Chris Froome is given similar treatment at the Tour, and this is maybe a trial run for that.
Will he be in a separate Froome to the rest of his teammates?
Oh dear, you're bad puns today.
It's a good subject, though. We've got more to say about motorhomes than we have about bike racing, haven't we?
Well, I covered the Tour twice in a camper van, and certainly the camper van that I was in 2006, 2007, you wouldn't volunteer to stay in it, that's for sure. Travelling around France, didn't have any air conditioning, it was a pretty gruelling experience at times.
And it's just come back to me that one of the most slipshod teams of the sort of late 90s, always rode the Giro. The Mobile Veta team, I think Berzin rode for them, Evgeny Berzin, they made camping cars, didn't they? So, you know, if only they were around now, they wouldn't have a problem finding nine for their riders, would they?
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
So the topic of motorhomes is no doubt one that we will return to. I think we've all got a lot more to say about that. Looking forward to seeing Chris Froome's motorhome at the Tour. We'll perhaps offer listeners a special insight into the motorhome, maybe try and get a little tour.
Well, I mean, the one thing the motorhome doesn't have, it's not particularly soundproofed, is it? I mean, I could imagine a load of Alberto Contador supporters gathering outside the Chris Froome motorhome, honking their horns and shouting and chanting and rocking it, maybe. You know,
I think you're imagining that he's in a pretty bog-standard motorhome, which I don't think it is.
It's just a Winnebago, isn't it? I mean, you could still cause havoc. You could climb on the roof and bang on the roof.
Daniel, you look like you were going to say something there, but then you changed your mind.
I forgot. We will be talking about all different kinds of doping over the next few weeks and months. We've had accommodation doping, we've had logistical doping, we've had other forms of camping car doping with Matt White.
I think I can see an accommodation doping T-shirt. Just remember, 2 C's and 2 M's.
Yeah, just give us some of your suggestions, listeners, for different types of doping.
Different T-shirts as well. Reminder, thecyclingpodcast.com shop.
But this, the motorhome could also be construed as a kind of financial doping, which we've spoken about before with regard to Team Sky, haven't we?
No, there's a lot more to come on that. What else can we look forward to over the next few days at the Giro, Daniel?
A couple of mountain stages this weekend, some fairly gentle mountain stages. Down in Ciro's neck of the woods, we talked about that earlier in the Giro d'Italia. Campitello Mattese is one of them, the name of the second summit finish down there near Napoli. It slips my mind at the moment. But, still kind of hors d'oeuvres before the real battle kicks off in the last week in the Alps, mainly, not the Dolomites. There's one Dolomite climb in this year's Giro d'Italia. That's the climb to Madonna di Campiglio, but any other mention of the Dolomites will be erroneous and frowned upon by the Dolomite police.
Okay, brilliant. Well, we should wrap it up there, chaps, I think. We will be back next week with more Giro chat. I think you're on holiday, Lionel.
Yeah, I'm on holiday. I won't be here next week. So whoever you get in my place, good luck to them.
Yeah, well, we're casting around for suitable stand-ins as we speak, but we're expecting a big name.
You've already got a loanee signed up, haven't you?
No, that's not confirmed yet. So we don't want to jump the gun on that one. But Lionel, thank you very much for joining us this week.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.